From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Sean Horn coming to you from New York all this week. On today's show, Barry Jenkins on turning James Baldwin's If Beale Street Could Talk into a movie.
I don't know, how can you not be lifted up by this conceptual idea of two young black people as soulmates? There's just something about that was so rich and potent and just lush that it grabbed me.
Then Beale Street composer Nicholas Britell, who's come a long way since his first job.
After college, my band broke up and the film that I had scored never came out. And I was looking for a job, and I actually got a job trading currencies in New York.
All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. With his 2016 film Moonlight, Barry Jenkins turned his camera on Liberty City, the predominantly black neighborhood of Miami, where he grew up. The film was a coming-of-age story about a young gay boy, his relationship with his mother, and with himself. Moonlight won the Academy Award for Best Picture. For his follow-up film, If Beale Street Could Talk, Jenkins adapted the 1974 novel of the same name. It was written by the author and social critic James Baldwin, and it's set in the writer's hometown of Harlem. The book and the movie tell the story of characters named Fonny and Tish who fall in love and get pregnant. Regina King plays Tish's mother.
We are drinking to new life. Tish gonna have Fonny's baby.
But Fonny's mother and sisters, who are deeply religious, have a different reaction. Then Fonny is charged for a rape that he didn't commit. But still, with so much chaos and suffering, there's a beauty to Beale Street, just as there was in Moonlight. The story is set in New York City. The actual Beale Street is in Memphis, and the movie opens with a reference to New Orleans. So when I sat down with Barry Jenkins, I asked him what all these places have in common.
Yeah, I think it's about the universality, you know, of the experience that Mr. Baldwin is depicting in the novel and that I also feel is depicted in the film. Just this common sort of like spirituality community, this common life force shared amongst black folks, especially in these enclaves, you know, whether they be in Memphis, Tennessee, New Orleans, Harlem, as you said, my hometown of Miami, Liberty City. I think all these places have these stories like the one that we see depicted in this film.
Your film, probably I would say even more so than the book, is a love story. It's a love story about two young people who are deeply in love with each other. And in one case in particular, the family of one that's trying to make sure that this couple is not ruined. Why did you respond so much to that part of the story and emphasize it? What did you want to say about these young lovers and about how much they meant to each other and how much their families were going to do whatever it took to make sure that they were together?
Yeah, you know, how much the young lovers meant to each other was the first thing that grabbed me. It jumps off the page in a certain way, and especially in this novel, because, you know, Mr. Baldwin wrote with two very distinct voices. He wrote with many voices, but there were two that always jumped out to me the most. One was just almost enraptured with this idea of sensuality, with love, with romance, with passion. The other one was just as searing about depicting societal injustices, and particularly the way that the lives and souls of black folks has been treated, you know, by the country that we all call home. And so when I read the book for the first time and saw just how devoted Tish and Fonny are to one another, how they're basically creating this world of two people, I was just, I don't know, how can you not be lifted up by that, this conceptual idea of two young black people as soulmates? There's just something about that was so rich and potent and just lush that it grabbed me. And then when you bring the families into it as well, what I loved about, because I wrote this at the same time that I wrote Moonlight, and Moonlight is a depiction of a certain kind of family. It's the family I grew up in. Beale Street features two very different families from the one I grew up in. But what I really felt like Mr. Baldwin was working out was within one scene, and in the film, there's a scene where you have eight actors sitting in a room, and it's these two families. Basically, they're basically negotiating, how do we treat the same problem, using air quotes, the same problem? You know, to one family, it's a blessing. To the other family, it's a problem. And I just love how you put all these very different depictions of blackness, of black family, of religion, all these different characters have a very different concept of the same thing. And so as they're trying to solve the same scenario, the same problem, they're all doing it with different tools. And I just love, as a dramatist, now I'm just speaking purely as somebody who gets to have fun making art, it's like, oh, this is delicious. And I think when you watch the sequence in the film, it does read as delicious with a capital D.
The other thing that Baldwin is writing about in your film is dealing with are the ideas of intersectionality. Mm-hmm. That on the one hand, Beale Street is talking about the way that black men are profiled and targeted and oppressed within our criminal justice system. And on the other hand, there is this sexual assault narrative. There's a story about this woman who was raped and she believes the wrong person has committed the rape. What is the balance you're trying to strike about those two issues so that they, I guess in some ways, complement each other, even though it sounds kind of horrible, without kind of clashing with each other?
Yeah, it wasn't about them complimenting or clashing with each other because, you know, so much of the work had already been done in the novel. And so even in the depiction of the sexual assault in the novel and in the film, it's like, what are we really looking at? You know, Fonny's not falsely accused of anything. He's chosen out of a police lineup.
Right.
He's placed in a police lineup by an extremely racist police officer. And then in this sequence between the officer, Tish, and Fonny, we see the exact moment when the officer decides, okay, I am going to teach you. And so when you really dig into the language of what's being understood, this idea of these two things being in concert and not being and not clashing, then it starts to reveal itself. And I think the fact that the character who was assaulted, Mrs. Victoria Rogers, she's Puerto Rican, because Baldwin is just playing with everything. How close to the American dream can you possibly get without being granted full access to it? You know, I mean, it's just so much in this book was so just like searingly just right at the edge. I mean, I think all these things are thrown into this pot together that creates this, because you mentioned New Orleans earlier, this gumbo, you know, that could only be described as Americana.
In terms of making art, Fonny is an artist himself. He's a sculptor. Why is that profession important? Because there's a scene in the film where we see him creating his art while he is thinking back to it as he's incarcerated. What does his art represent to him? And why was it important to represent it in the film?
I think he found in the sculpting and this art a way to express himself that cannot be corrupted, that cannot be taken away from him by anyone but his own intellectual limitations. You know, if he has the desire to create something, he can go get a block of wood and create it. Now, me making the film, the sequence you're talking about comes into the end of the movie where, you know, we finally get to see Stephon James as Fonny working on this piece of art, trying to finesse this block of wood into a vision, but because of the circumstances that have befallen him, he just can't. And he's just walking around it, circling it. And I remember when I first understood that I wanted to make films, kind of feeling the same way. And I think it's lovely that, you know, this movie's an adaptation, Moonlight was an adaptation as well, so it's not autobiographical, but there are moments when myself and the characters completely align. And when I think of both the character and Stephon James circling this thing that could be manifested into something either horrific or beautiful and almost being paralyzed, I'm like, oh, I know what that feels like.
Coming up, Barry Jenkins maintains that love, family, and community are what will get us through.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal says it's fresh from thunderous start to exquisite finish, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. For consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're talking about the making of If Beale Street Could Talk with filmmaker Barry Jenkins. The movie, which opens in limited release on December 14th, stars two relatively unknown actors. Newcomer Kiki Layne plays Tish, and Stephon James plays Fonny.
I like to say casting is a meritocracy, and on this film, Cindy Tolan was the casting director. Cindy discovered Jason Mitchell as Eazy-E in the film Straight Outta Compton, so I knew she could sort of like look and sift and, you know, find the diamonds in the rough, as they say. And with this film, the most important thing was this idea of soulmates, you know, between Tish and Fonny, but also between Regina King and Coleman Domingo, you know, as Tish's parents. And I think Cindy just had a very open idea of what that looked like and what it felt like. And so, you know, when we were casting this very wide net, you know, we were going to look at someone who had no credits just as diligently as we looked at someone who had 100 credits.
I want to ask you about the gatekeepers, the people who allow stories like this to get told and those who thwart them, when you're thinking about how the industry welcomes or does not welcome diverse storytellers, what needs to change so that we get to see films that look a lot more like the country and not like movies that are made by a bunch of white guys?
Yeah, I think, oh man, John Horn said that, not Barry Jenkins. It's a multi-prong, a multifaceted issue, and I do think it's an issue. I think there's a couple things. One, most importantly, you know, we have to consider it a direction, not a destination. There have been so many times where we've thought, oh, we need change, and we set a signpost, and we go, oh, change is done, we got there, we don't need this thing anymore. And then we realize, no, we were very premature. So it needs to be a direction and not a destination. You know, we're always in the path of progress. I think you look at a film like Black Panther with its amazing success. It's so clear the audience is there. And then you look at someone like Ava DuVernay, who's made a mandate where every person who directs an episode of Queen Sugar is going to be a woman, just to show and prove that these women who have not directed an episode of television can, of course, come in and direct an episode of television because they've been doing it on their indie films. And so I think the more we're doing these things out in the world and we're really planting a flag to go, see, it worked here, it'll work there. See, this audience is here, the audience will be there. Then these myths that always somehow every 3 years come back up, oh, black films don't travel overseas. Well, actually, Moonlight made more money overseas than it made domestically. Let's not forget that conveniently 2 years later. And I think we're at a stage right now where people aren't being allowed to forget those things. So I do think we're on the path of progress.
Moonlight actually made more overseas than...
Yes, sir, it did. Yes, it did. See?
I know.
See?
No, and the other thing I think that we haven't talked about is critics. I think if you have critics who come from diverse backgrounds and look at the world differently than most traditionally white male critics, that changes the way that movies are reviewed and the conversations that happen around them.
The best thing I'll say about that is there are sequences in both these films, in Moonlight and in Beale Street, where depending on the personal experience you bring into the auditorium, there were just things you pick up on. That's fine, because here's the thing. I've been doing that for years. You know, we all have. People of color have been watching material, ingesting media that is not set in the worlds that we're from for years. And it's fine. We still find a way to enjoy it. And so now that the shoe is on the other foot, you're right. There are certain things and the nuance, you know, and the subtlety and the foundation of this work that, yes, because the group that is watching these things and is then the mouthpiece that's showing you, this is what I saw in this thing. It's like, but if you can't see it all, then are you maybe not the best person, but should you be the only person that's talking about this? The answer to that is definitely no.
The title of the book and the title of your movie doesn't have a question mark, If Beale Street Could Talk. But if Beale Street could talk, what would it say? What would its take be on the world today?
I think its take on the world today is, you know, there's a scene in the movie with Dave Franco, and, you know, Dave is this landlord who's showing Tish and Fonny an apartment. And to conclude the scene, he very simply says, you know, Fonny asks him, you know, I don't know why, what it is that makes you decide to treat two Negroes so nice-like, is the line Fonny says. And Dave Franco's character, Levy, says, well, you know, I'm just my mother's son. Sometimes it's the only thing that makes a difference between us and them. You assume the us and them is black and white. But it's not. You know, the us and them is people who've been nurtured, people who have foundation, people who have loved, who have families, and the people who don't. And I feel like we have to find a way. And I think what the movie is saying as well is that this idea of love, family, community, that's the thing that's going to get us through these very dark times.
Yeah. The other thing the landlord says is he dug people who loved each other.
He does say that, too. He does say that, too. Let's take it from the book.
Barry Jenkins, great to see you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horn.
Now we turn to a composer who's become essential to Barry Jenkins' filmmaking. When Nicholas Britell first read the script for Moonlight, he thought it was like reading a poem, and it inspired him to write the score that you're hearing now. Britell also composed the score for If Beale Street Could Talk, which Jenkins adapted from a novel by James Baldwin. At a recent live event hosted by The Frame and KPCC's In Person, Britell said that Barry Jenkins' first instruction to him was to evoke Baldwin's love of jazz.
Barry had these great first instincts of horns and brass, you know. So what I started doing was I started exploring that texture of horns and brass. So thinking trumpet, flugelhorn, French horn, and exploring, in a lot of ways, I think the orchestration of it is completely linked with the notes for me, with the composition of it. The sounds and the sound world, the colors of different instruments completely change the meaning for me of the pieces. So I can actually, there was the first chords and ideas I had, I was following this idea of brass and thinking of New York in mid-20th century, let's say the early 1970s. But so I was using jazz harmonies in a way, but then I was also kind of writing it out very classically at the same time. So the first chords I wrote were actually, it was this melody. And there's a piece that I did where feeling these sort of chords. So feeling those ideas, but with brass. So actually, I can. Should we yep. play this track yep. here?
I want to ask you about this idea of foreshadowing, because Beale Street is a love story, but it's a love story where somebody has been unjustly accused of a crime. So you are working in juxtaposition to a couple of ideas, beauty and ugliness at the same time. And there's kind of a convention of bad scoring where somebody comes on screen, we hear like the villain's theme, and we know that that's going to be the guy who's going to kill everybody. But as a composer, how do you think about the better, smarter version of that, where you're suggesting in things that things look good, but maybe they're not? How do you do that musically?
Different types of films require different, like a different dialectic. Films that are more fantasy-like will require more music oftentimes. So for example, you know, imagine Star Wars. The score is big, the fantasy is big, you know. Different genres require different music. With Beale Street, I think, and with Moonlight, it was really a question of discovering what is that dialectic. And it's something that I don't think we knew at first exactly how that was going to come together. In Beale Street, what we ended up finding together was we had explored the world of joy and the world of love. There's a piece which we first hear when Tish and Fani make love for the first time, a piece called Eros. And you'll notice on the score, we named different pieces after the ancient Greek words for love. So there's a piece called Agape, there's a piece called Eros, Philia, Storge. So with Eros, which is these kind of chords. So those chords form the basis of this piece Eros, which is written out for cellos, actually, all cellos. And there's this scene between the character Daniel and Fani, and Daniel has just gotten out of prison and he starts telling Fani about his experience there. And in the sequence, we're hearing Blue and Green by Miles Davis playing on a record player. And when I first started looking at the sequence and working with Barry on it, I said, you know, what if we went to score in the midst of their conversation? And there's some sort of feeling of the horror of Daniel's experience. And then Barry says, well, what if we keep the Miles Davis going? What we wound up with was actually taking that piece Eros and taking elements of the cellos that I'd recorded and bending them and distorting them. And Barry would actually say, he would say, how do we break it? And what happens to the cello and the breaking of it and the harming to it is, in a sense, what the injustice is doing to the love that's in the film.
Coming up, Nicholas Britell's first job out of college wasn't composing for film, it was trading currencies on Wall Street. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now we continue my conversation at the piano with Academy Award-nominated film composer Nicholas Britell. His first big break was on Adam McKay's 2015 movie, The Big Short, which was about the 2008 housing crisis and financial collapse. It's the music that you're hearing now. Britell has also re-teamed with McKay on Vice, his movie about former Vice President Dick Cheney. It stars Christian Bale as the Vice President, and it comes out on Christmas Day. We pick up the conversation now with Britell and his life after Harvard, where he had the fortune of meeting film producer Jeremy Kleiner.
After college, my band broke up, and the film that I had scored never came out, and I was looking for a job, and I actually got a job trading currencies in New York. And I was hired by a composer, actually, and he was sort of like, you know, we'll find something for you to do here. So I did that for a while in New York, and I think one day I was talking to Jeremy, and he was like, you know, I have this script. It's The Big Short, actually. It's the Michael Lewis novel we're turning into a film. And he connected me with Adam, and I sent him a couple ideas, just talked to him on the phone, and he said something like he was trying to imagine what dark math sounded like. And I sent him some ideas, and we had a conversation, and he thankfully really liked what I sent him, so he hired me.
So now I want to ask you about Vice, and I'm sure there's a clever way of saying there are similarities between the financial meltdown and Dick Cheney, but when you start thinking about the themes of this movie, and it's not just about Dick Cheney, it's about his relationship with his wife, mm-hmm. it's about his troubled past, about his growth into power. Where do you start? And what are your first conversations with Adam about on this film?
Well, in the same way that I think the immersive kind of collaborative approach that Barry and I utilize gets us to places that we wouldn't expect, I think, you know, you do start with initial instincts and then you see how they feel in the movie. In the case of Vice, Adam's initial instinct was that it needed a very symphonic scope. Because as he would say, this is such a huge story. That initial instinct led me to think about, well, what is the sound of that? What is the music? And for me, you know, reading the script, talking to Adam, there was this sense of dissonance that I wanted to weave into the movie. And the way that I explored it was, I think there's, you know, if we think about an American sound, you know, of what that might be, an American orchestral sound, and then if you think about what a hero's journey in a film might sound like, this isn't exactly that story. It's a very specific take and variation on those stories, and the variation is with dissonance. So what I would do is I would explore, for example, a trumpet fanfare, and I would imagine to myself, you know, okay, we can have a trumpet fanfare, but what if very occasionally there's a note that's wrong? So, you know, you can take this kind of feeling. So, you know, I'm taking these sort of, you know, you could imagine more of like a, you know, kind of brass, kind of a fanfare, but instead I'm taking something where I'm, there's these notes that like you're sort of, what is something right, is something wrong? And in the main theme idea, which is actually, we call it the lineman theme, because when Dick Cheney was young, he actually worked the power lines in Wyoming. That was before he went to Washington and became a congressional intern under Donald Rumsfeld. So there's this theme which is orchestrated for the end of the film, and it's orchestrated where all of those parts are playing, but there's actually 80 strings playing and 6 harps.
Nick doesn't know I'm going to do this, but Adam McKay has said that he sees Big Short and Vice as two parts of a trilogy. And the third film, he thinks, is about climate change. So we're going to skip ahead a year or so. Adam McKay is making a movie about climate change. The title is Thin Ice. The hero of the story is a government scientist who has all of this great scientific data, and he's fighting the fight within the White House to convince them that climate change is not a myth perpetuated by the Chinese. So I'm Adam. I want some ideas for a theme for this scientist.
Totally. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So I think that's interesting. You know, I think my first response to something like that is I think you know, maybe if it's part of a trilogy with The Big Short and Vice, maybe there is an element of dissonance too, possibly. So let me think here. Not doing that ever. Too obvious. And also, I don't think that's at all what we're feeling. And that's the thing, you know, a lot of the time you'll be, I remember reading in, Stravinsky had gave these great lectures at Harvard and called The Poetics of Music. And one of the things that he talked about in them was that sometimes he would just go to the piano and he would drop his hands and he would sort of see where they go. And see how to work out of that. You know, composing a lot of the time, if you're at a piano, it becomes sometimes a very physical process where your hands kind of go to certain places habitually. And so one thing that I like to do is different keys have different feelings. So, you know, I would say, okay, let's try to do this, but let's do it in F sharp. So you're already getting, I'm already thinking of stuff that I didn't think of before. So, you know, there's different ways like that. And what's fun about it is then it almost matches the same kind of experimentation that I want to do when I'm sitting with a director. And there are definitely times where, you know, the piano holds you back too, where you'll, you know, if I'm, sometimes, you know, I'll write music on an airplane because I'm just a piece of manuscript paper and it's a different, it triggers sort of different part of your brain.
Nick Bertel, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
That conversation was recorded in front of a live audience as part of KPCC's in-person series. And that's the show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.